Yeah, a little bit. When I was asked to chair this meeting, well, I hate to always say, like, we always did it this way, but I've been involved with this event for a long time, and historically, the person that asked this main speaker to speak usually introduces them. I didn't do that, but I was asked to chair this meeting, and I quickly said yes, because our speaker tonight is someone who's been very special in my recovery. Around 16 years ago, my home group was in Altoona at the time, and we decided to get involved with this area. And in a land far away, in time long ago, in Johnstown, our area service used to meet. And I remember meeting this gentleman, my very first area service meeting. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I agreed because I lived closest to Johnstown to become our GSR, and the gift of service was given to me at that first meeting. I saw a whole bunch of crazy people yelling at each other, and I really don't remember too much more than that, other than the fact that as they walked out the door, they had all gotten okay with what had happened in that room, and I finally saw what a weed was starting to become. I missed our first retreat here. I relapsed a couple months later, and I haven't missed any since. And in those first couple of years, this gentleman was sharing 1 year, and him and I got to be kind of close at that point. I found out that I could actually have an intimate relationship with another man in this fellowship and share about what really goes on inside between these two crazy years, and he could do that with me. And although we don't get to spend much time together anymore, we shared a home group for a whole lot of years, and I did a lot of service together as well, so we've had a hell of a lot of fun. We got to go to the Atlanta World Convention together. Hope to see him a little bit this week, just next weekend in Philadelphia. I'm always happy to hear a message of recovery to him, because I know most importantly it comes from my heart. And with that, I will give you John Kay from the Clean and Serene group in the Camna area.
I'm John, I'm an addict. Man, what a long, beautiful ride it's been. That was a touching introduction. This is, without a doubt, touching my heart. Is I have a long history, as Rich just said. I was this retreat's chair the first year and the second year. There's a handful of us that put this together, and there's a lot of work going into this becoming what it has and staying. You know, as I was sitting there listening to that fire and listening to the readings and the introduction, I couldn't help but think about the reading We Do Recover. And over these years, how many faces I can't even remember that are gone, that aren't here anymore. How many faces that aren't here, yet are here, simply because they took the ball and ran with it, worked steps, got a home group, and got a life, and life happened to take them away from here somewhere else. You know, there's a lot of reasons why that person next to you may not be there tomorrow. What I find is it's important just to make sure that I'm the one that's still here. And hopefully you are too. And if you're not, hopefully you're in a decent spot somewhere else in the rooms, in another area, another region. It's been a little bit odd for me lately because even listening to the introduction, Rich knows my heart on this. I haven't had the heart to resign from my old home group because I was part of it since 1994. And there was a real short blip where I left it to go to Punxsutawney to help a struggling meeting. And it eventually folded and I went back. But where I live at now, I was driving an hour and 15 minutes one way to my home group. You know, so if you're new, if you're old, if you forgot what passion is, if you don't have passion about your life and your recovery, chances are you might not be here for a long time. Because I always lived my life like I was a cat and I got 9 lives. Today I understand that I only get 1. And that I need to treat it with respect and care and love and concern and passion. Those are the things that I walked in here with. Those are things that I learned over time as a result of staying here and going through these trials and tribulations that unfold in here. You know, both the step work, you know, and looking at self and the service work, as Rich was talking, the arguments and the conflicts and having to, you know, get right with, you know, personalities and core principles. When I got here, if you would have told me my life would have evolved to become what it is today, I couldn't have comprehended it. And I grew up on the inner city streets of Pittsburgh. And shit, it was nothing for me to jump on my 20-inch single speed and run down and go through the Liberty Tunnels and go down into the little adult bookie things and swapping quarters or playing the jukebox and doing all the wrong things as a kid. The other thing popped in my mind when I was listening to that We Do Recover reading, I grew up with a set of twins, and their father was raging alcoholic. One day we came home from playing football, and I was only about 50 feet from the house. They were going in the door, and I heard the shot. I heard them scream. I turned around and ran back over. He was waiting for them inside the door at the top of the steps for them to open the door. He had a gun under his chin and pulled the trigger right in front of him. And he lived. And he started going to AA, and that was like the first time I can ever remember hearing anything about any kind of an anonymous fellowship. And back then, all I thought was some place that, you know, they brainwashed you. You know, and, you know, today it's like I understand things a little bit differently. There's a story that I came across a few years ago, and I just can't seem to really get too far into doing this anymore without telling it, because it's such a true statement of the way we evolve. And what the story is there's this guy who goes into a doctor's office and he says he has the shingles. And the receptionist said, okay, here, fill out this paperwork and the doctor will be right with me. And he says, well, but I just have the shingles. And she said, well, just fill out the paperwork. We'll get the doc and he'll be all right. So he fills out the paperwork and he's sitting there and the nurse comes out, takes him in the back and puts the blood pressure thing on and starts taking the blood pressure. And he says, well, yeah, I just have the shingles. And she said, yeah, I know. You know, be all right. The doc will be in to see you. And sits the mom rings, you know, but I just have the shingles. Talking with his mom in his mouth. And so finally she leaves and the doc comes in and he said, hi, I'm, you know, Doc Smith, and, you know, what can I do for you? And he says, I have the shingles. And the doc looks at the chart and says, well, I guess I only need to see him. And he says, well, they're out in the pickup truck. He was there to do the roof. They're getting a new roof on the building. Okay. Now, The point behind that is what we see isn't necessarily what we get. We get what we're capable of seeing. And before I got here, the only thing that I was capable of seeing is what my addiction allowed me to see. I wasn't free by any means. I was a prisoner. And I had no clue to what depths I was a prisoner. And, I had some moments in my journey that, I grew up, I don't know, somewhere along the line, I can't say that I didn't have positive stuff in my life, but for whatever reason, I learned all the negative and the unhealthy stuff. One of my earliest memories in life is my father shoving a whole bunch of paper underneath the bedroom mattress that he heard me coming up the steps and going, don't tell mom. And what it was all his numbers. He had a problem with gambling. You know, so what do you think I'd learned as a kid, you know? Keep secrets, lie, don't tell the truth. And, and in other ways, like, I can remember my father saying, hey, don't make plans on Saturday, you know, I need you to help with the roof. And as a little kid, you're being excited and wanting to get out on that roof with Dad and help, you know. Saturday came, and I went to go out the window to get on the roof, and Dad said, I'll run downstairs, give me a screwdriver. Ran downstairs, got the screwdriver, gave it to him, started to get out on the roof. No, run downstairs, give me a throw fall. That went on all afternoon. I never got out on the roof. And the message that I chose to learn was I wasn't good enough or couldn't do things, you know. I was incapable of perceiving that it was a parent and he was just worried his kid might fall off the roof. You know, so for whatever reason, when I was young, I gravitated towards that negativity in believing in the worst. And it took for me to get here to learn how to, like, undo that. Because my roadmap was broken before I got here. It's like a GPS sometimes. But won't go there. Anyways, you know, my roadmap was broken, and I had all the things that were happening to me. I couldn't keep jobs, and you know, hell, I didn't even do anything in high school. I did 8 years of Catholic grade school, straight A student, went to a public high school, and never showed up for class, and still graduated. Because the coaches, I knew how to manipulate the coaches. They'd go talk to the teachers and tell them we need them on the team. Now I learned how to, you know, play people. And I control manipulation stuff that we do. And, you know, that wasn't my dream. My dream, I can remember my childhood dream when I was a kid. When I was in that Catholic grade school, I wanted to go to CMU. I wanted to get a degree in being an electrical engineer. By the time I graduated high school, I knew how bad I was with partying and doing drugs, because I was already into the drugs. And I told myself I was going to give myself a year, and then I'd go to college. I remember that I told myself that when I was 38 years old. You know, when I left high school, my life just deteriorated. I didn't see any way of getting a good job, didn't have contacts, thought my life would always amount to, you know, basically nothing, because I grew up in a poor neighborhood. My parents didn't have two nickels to rub together. You know, I grew up as an only child. Yeah, I was spoiled with love, but not material stuff by any means. And sometimes I'm not even sure I would call some of it love. I mean, I ain't saying my parents didn't love me, but there's a difference between love and enabling. You know, my parents were my best enablers. They probably helped me to stay in my addiction, you know, extra few years. So I ended up getting in trouble with the law 2 years before I got here. And my first introduction to this program was basically, you know, what the committees do, you know, PI, you know. Someone knew someone, you know, because of that type of stuff in the neighborhood, and I agreed to meet the guy in a meeting down in Southside, and I asked him to be my sponsor, and I met him again the following week at the same meeting, and I seen guys hugging guys, or people talking about God, and that was all my excuses. I wasn't ready. You know, I came in with a closed mind. I wasn't willing to succeed. I came in for the wrong reasons. I came in because I wanted my parents off my back. I wanted my girlfriend off my back. And I tried to stay clean for a while on my own, and it failed miserably. I started having the beer on Friday nights. I managed to do that for few weeks, you know how that goes. Sometimes it doesn't even go that far, but to me, I managed to do it for a few weeks. And I don't consider what I'm saying right here a relapse, because I never had anything that I relapsed from. I went to two meetings. I didn't even have a clue what it was about. Then I started drinking again. I went to the Bahamas on a vacation. When I got off the ship, I was already drunk, and whenever the native held out his hand with what I really wanted, it was on. And 2 years of my life went by in a blink of an eye. But whenever it finally came crashing down, I remembered 2 years prior going to those meetings and the things I heard. And I remember the judge saying, you need help. So the cunning manipulative addict that I was, I figured I'd try to manipulate the system and start going to these meetings and go to some rehabs. And when I got in front of that judge, he tapped me on the back and said, you've been a good boy, don't let me see you again. Didn't work out that way. In 10 months and a day, I had, about 30 of you guys down at the Allegheny Courthouse. About 26 of you guys didn't even tell me you were coming. And I ended up taking a guilty plea, and I went away. And I still have a legal sheet of paper that's filled with hundreds of names of people that wrote me on a regular basis. And I didn't realize until I came home that I actually managed to do a meeting a day, every day, while I was away, even though I didn't have a meeting, simply because I managed to spend probably an hour and a half to 3 hours a day writing letters, answering letters, because people cared enough. When I was away, one of the things that was really difficult was I wasn't able to get meetings in there. There was a point in time where I got to be a part of a rehabilitation community in there, but we couldn't get people from the outside in. It was, like, so difficult. And I managed to get my sponsor and another guy in one time. That was it. You know, the whole time, it was like 9 months I was in there. So whenever I got out, one of my passions was that I would become involved in H&I when I had an opportunity. And it took a while for me to meet the requirements because I had a long parole that tagged me. But the day I was eligible, I was going into jail. I went into Indiana County Jail for 7 years straight, and then Pine Grove and Quahana Boot Camp, and I was going into a jail every week for 10 years straight. And that's what my real passion is. Even though I'm not involved in it and haven't been for a while, that's what my real passion is in this program, that and step work. Speaking of step work, you know, I did go back in history so that I don't forget this, because one of the one of the, oh man, there's so many blessings from this retreat. It's I was asked the first year to choose the main speaker, and I called a fellow that I heard out in Baltimore at the World Convention that I really liked what he shared. He had the willingness to come, but he had prior commitment. And I thought about another fellow I met at the World Convention in St. Louis, and same thing happened. But there was a guy that got me connected to them, and the guy that connected me to them, via phone numbers, the conversation I had with him, I spent like 3 hours talking to this fellow on the phone, and everything that he talked about was about the sponsorship family and unity, and you know, you could tell he's like, you know, really heavy into service, and he would talk about the step work that they would do in their sponsorship family meetings, and I took a risk without having heard, you know, a tape or anything, and asked the guy to come up and be our Saturday night speaker, and he brought a sponsor with him. And the minute I met his sponsor, I was glued to this guy. There was a definite bond instantaneously between me and this man. And he was talking a little bit about relationships in the hallway over in that lodge over there. And that weekend, one of the speakers for the workshop relationships didn't show up, and the programming chair came over and asked me for a suggestion, and I pointed right at the guy and said, there's your speaker right there. It was one of the only workshops I heard that weekend. And I sat in the front row, and he was talking about when we go to AA, they do these handshakes. And then whenever we come in here, we do these long distance hugs. And then at some point, you know, we do the good hug, and when we're a little more comfortable with ourselves, we do the firm hug without the pat on the back, just for the nervousness. And at some point, and he kissed me on the cheek, he said that becomes acceptable too, even between two men or two women. And it buckled my knees, and it wasn't a sexual thing. What it was I was up here in this area, and I hadn't let men get close to me up here. I had relationships like that with the men down in Pittsburgh that I left when I moved up here. You know, and shortly after that, my sponsor, you know, I felt like asking him to be my sponsor that weekend just because of the stuff that took place, you know, and I realized that there wasn't anything wrong with my sponsor. The only thing was wrong with him is that I forgot how to dial his number. So I started dialing him on a regular basis. And after about 6 months, he said to me, I can't sponsor you anymore. And I, like, knew something was wrong with that. Because we don't tell someone we can't sponsor him. And I said, what's going on? He said, man, you've been calling me every day for months, and I'm giving you good stuff, and I can't save my own ass. He says, I've been using. And I took him, I went down to Pittsburgh, and I took him to a meeting the next day, and when we walked in, he was a rock star person in this program. And I suggest anyone that starts to develop that in here, you put an end to it quick, because none of us are better or less than anybody else in here. You know, that's all too giant, and I watched what he went through. When I took him in that meeting, he didn't walk in there with the body language, I'm happy, joyous, and free. He walked in with his head hung over. I'd never, ever seen him with his head hung over. His shoulders rounded. Someone said, how you doing? He kind of struggled to lift his head and said, I used it. They slapped him on the back. Said, oh, that's funny. You know, said his name. And went to the meeting. And I was dumbfounded. Like, you know, did they just miss? And that's the denial process. You know, sometimes we put people on pedestals in here, and there ain't no pedestals. We're all recovering addicts. You know, we're just one fix, one drink, one whatever, you know, from being caught in the grip. You know, and if you hear something that I said tonight, please don't sign my name to it. You know, I'm standing up here just being of service and getting another hire clean, because while I'm standing here talking to you guys, I ain't using. You know? And sometimes it is really just that simple. So I ended up having to get a new sponsor, and I went down to the Chesapeake Potomac, the Ocean City Convention, and on the way back, I stopped in Baltimore because that man that I was referring to that I wanted to have to be my sponsor lived in Baltimore. And I knew where he lived. I knocked on his door. He opened the door, and I said, you willing? He said, I wonder what took so long. And he said, and I did stuff work with the other sponsor, but he's the sponsor I got down and dirty with. And I attribute a large part of who I am today as a result of putting the effort into myself with him. And coming to terms and understanding of who I am and what I have to offer on a daily basis and provide this planet, this world, and serve my higher power. You know, and one of the biggest things I find in serving my higher power is an effort. We get misled when we get caught up in effort. You know, we take a service position, and I'm guilty of it. I did it all the time. You know, I'm doing this. I'm somebody because I'm doing that. And, you know, that's like, you know, being active in a church and doing all this wonderful stuff at a church, and you get up to the pearly gates, and you think that you're somebody because you did all this work. God don't care about that. God cares that you surrender to him. this program cares that you surrender to it. And the way I understand the steps, I have a relationship with that God that we start to develop in steps 2 and 3. So I need to start surrender to what I understand of that God. Don't get me wrong, when I put effort and do stuff, that does help build my self-esteem and self-respect, because I didn't know how to do that stuff. I wasn't responsible before I got here. I didn't even have any clue what I was capable of when it came to responsibility. Shit, when I was in the penitentiary, I used to pray on a daily basis, please don't let my parents die. Please, please, please don't let them die while I'm in here. Because I didn't know if I'd be able to handle that. God sometimes has a sense of humor. He kept on long lines enough to see that I'd become their parent. Shortly around the time that sponsor that did all the down dirty work, by the way, I went through 15 months of him fighting cancer. And Randy C. is a recovered addict now. He's with his higher power. And I don't get through many weeks without thinking about that man. One of the last things he asked me before he died was that what we did in step work, that I pay it forward. That was the only thing he asked of me. My 8th anniversary, instead of giving me an 8-year medallion, he gave me a freaking insanity coin. He told me that he believed I was one of the few that would actually make it to the end without using. I hope I didn't let him down. I believe I won't, but I don't know. I don't play that lie. But that's an awesome feeling, to have someone believe in you that much. You know, in early recovery, someone that I had on a pedestal when I was young in recovery, I thanked. I said, thanks. He said, for what? And I didn't know what I was thanking him for. I didn't have an answer. I was just standing there dumbfounded. I didn't expect him to say that. You know, and for a minute, I realized just what I was probably doing in that moment was people-pleasing, patting them on the back, you know, feel-good moment. So I went home and I had like to actually think. And what I came to was that what I was really thanking him for, and I wasn't quite sure that that's what I was the fact that he believed in me before I was capable of believing in myself. You know, and that's what we do when we come in here. You know, I'm so grateful for all the people who believed in me when I walked in there, because I sure as hell couldn't believe in myself. You know, he's going to the penitentiary, he's going to have a felony record that was going to carry me around the rest of my life, wasn't ever going to be able to mount anything. You guys know that story, right? Today I got a whole bunch of letters behind my last name. People think I'm a doctor. I'm not a doctor, but I get called doctor on a daily basis. And I have to explain to them what I am, and I'm not a doctor. And that's a result of this retreat, too. Sitting up on that hill right above these trees here on the flat field. Good friend of mine in recovery. I asked him to speak on triangle self-obsession. He came out to want me to speak, and we were sitting around the campfire. He had just put a deposit down on a franchise that has to deal with the medical field, and he was bleeding on me. He was afraid of whether he was doing the right thing for his family, taking that kind of risk. If he failed, where would they be? And I was reassuring him that God didn't carry him that far to drop him, and I was reassuring him how good he was at what he did, because I knew what he did and how good he was. And I call it divine intervention, divine accident. I didn't think about my thoughts or the words that came out of my mouth next. I asked him if they were hiring, because I was sick of my own job. And he said, yeah, he helped me get, you know, load a resume and get the job. He called me up a few days later and said, you know, I can help you get that job, but I'd rather you be patient. I'll hire you and train you. And we talked about it, and instead of doing the short circuit route that most people get in the field I'm in, and they fail, and I had a little bit of money saved, and I lived off the 401k for about 6 months with no income. And he helped me out by providing me a roof to stay in whenever I would drive up to State College and work for the week or learn. And then I had to go to school, and I had to take all kinds of tests, and then go back to more school. And nothing in life happens for me if I sit around and wish for it. I got to get up off the couch, turn the TV off, and go do the effort. Take the action. I wouldn't have what I have today if I didn't do that. I wouldn't have the understanding of who I am if I didn't do the effort when it came to doing step work. But whether you believe you can or can't, you're right. You know, this program has afforded me the opportunity not only to believe, but to know I can. Most of the time, not all the time, I still get my weak moments where my low self-esteem creeps in, but most of the time, I function from a point, and I don't mean it in an arrogant sense, I just know that I can. Because I've won enough battles, I've survived enough. I've been through countless battles in the years that I've been here. I don't know if I said my clean date, and I don't really like to say it, but I don't need to say it. I've been here a long time. Those nights, you know, a lot of the things that ...29 years ago, in my active addiction, I went up to a 4th of July party at this gated community because my buddy had bought some property up there, and I was ripped. I remember walking down to the lake and looking at some of these houses on this lake and thinking, wow, what an awesome place. I'll never live somewhere like this. And I did years of service work here in the home group and, you know, down in Pittsburgh. And as a result of that job that I got, he eventually ended up buying territory where that lake was at. And one thing led to another, and I remember being up there, and I went in just for something to do because I didn't have anything to do. And next thing I know, I was buying a house on that lake. And about a month after I was in that house, I went for a walk, and I was down by the marina, and I was standing just about in the spot that I was all those years ago, and hadn't remembered that I had stood there and once said that. And I got filled with tears because I couldn't have planned that. I couldn't have planned that. I didn't try to do that. See, I'm a firm believer that what I chase turns to mist and smoke and falls through my fingertips. When I chase my higher power, he knows my heart's desires and sometimes fulfills them in ways that I'm not capable of. You know, I need to always just stay here and stay grounded. It's been foreign to me because for many years I wore multiple hats many years. And for years now I've just been, you know, taking care of my home. When I became a parent's parent, a lot of stuff came to an end as far as my free time. I stopped being able to travel. I stopped being able to go skiing, fishing, a lot of things I like to do because I understood commitment. I understood relationships. I understood responsibility. I'm not saying I necessarily always liked it, And I'm ashamed to even say that, you know, because I sometimes feel like it robbed me of life. But that's pretty damn self-centered. And I never said I wasn't an addict either. You know, I ended up moving my mother in with me for 5 years because we had surrendered my father to a nursing home. And, you know, some things you just do the best you can with, but I sometimes come home and I still hear her voice. You didn't eat, did you? Would you like something to eat? Was that negativity? You know, that used to go right through me. And then I'd get in a shitty mood with her and be smart. And I had to remember that she didn't have a program, I did. You know, and I needed to practice acceptance, not control. You know? And where did I learn how to practice acceptance and not control? Probably in my home group, group conscience, area service, when something wasn't going the way I wanted it to, or someone was doing something I didn't think they should be doing. You know? Sometimes I just need to accept it. Because I have a choice in whether I, you know, give up my freedom. You know, I didn't understand it. I caused most all the drama in my life by the way I thought about what you did. You know? Well, what you said. If you said something I didn't like, I gave you all the power. And whatever you said is just what you said. I don't have to take ownership of it. I didn't know that. You know, it's okay to allow you to have your insanity today. It's okay for you to allow me to have mine. You know? And, actually, I had some insanity today. My life's been a blur last month. I was like thinking, I can't think of, I don't know, years ago I used to like do these leads in my head. And it was cool because I get all this good stuff and then I get up here, find out whatever come up, but at least I got the lead, you know? And now it's like whenever I get asked to do this stuff, my mind's blank. Even if I try to think about what I'm going to say, there's something there that just blocks it. I can't. I have no idea. And I sometimes get nervous like that, like almost, you know, get up here and not say anything. And I know that's a lie because I can talk. You know? Love you too, Mel. Yeah, that's one of the beautiful things about Randy C, who passed away. He was my sponsor. I already knew how, to a large degree, to have relationships with men in my life. He extended my knowledge of that to another level. And I am so blessed with men in my life, especially the ones that I have the privilege of sponsoring. And there's been many days over the years that they have saved my ass because I don't believe in sponsorship as a one-way street. If something's going on in my life and someone I'm sponsoring calls me, I don't say, hey, I got to call my sponsor. I give it to them. You know, then I'll call my sponsor. But that's like group conscience to me, too. You know, like my sponsor ain't going to always have everything. I've always looked at that second tradition, you know, as far as like I tie that into the first word of the first step, we. That was the most valuable lesson I ever learned, was allowing myself to be part of you and you part of me, because I can't do it alone, we know that. And, you know, second tradition is about, you know, the group conscience. Well, whenever I'm going through something, if I call Rich, I call my sponsor, and I call John, I call Adam, they may not all individually have the answer, but they all might have a piece, and the conscience of talking to them, I get what I need. You know, I've had some beautiful moments with sponsees too, and I got going into the penitentiaries, there's two guys that I sponsor now. You know, we're not allowed to sponsor people while they're in there. But when they came up, they looked me up directly. And they're two of my closest friends today. Yeah, I might be the sponsor, but, you know, I love them guys. And, you know, to watch what they do with their kids and how they're able to be a father, the one in particular, and the things that have unfolded in his life, it just boggles my mind. You know, but I don't know, it is now 14, 15 years ago, I had a lot of chemical relapse, but I had spiritual relapse, a behavioral relapse, one that I wasn't proud of by any means. I had like a clubhouse in Indiana, and the meeting always happened after the meeting in my place. Sometimes I'd get up at 6 a.m. to go to work, and they'd still be at the dining table. You have to wave through the smoke to see them, you know, and I'd say, oh, I'll see you tonight, and I'd get home later that night, and they'd still be sitting there playing cards, drinking coffee. And that was all right, you know, as long as they weren't using. And sometimes I didn't go to work. Sometimes I sat there and did it with them. You know, because I had a job then that I could get away with that. But one of the guys that I had living there had relapsed. And I went down to the Hill District and yanked him out of the hill by 3 in the morning, and we went to a meeting later that night. And outside the meeting, the fellow that was our landlord was standing there, and he overheard some of the conversation. He was one of us. And he went directly to a probation officer and shared that information with the probation officer. And not only did the guy that I just rescued out of the hill quit coming to the meetings, four other guys that I was sponsoring that were on probation quit coming to the meetings too. And John went, he bypassed anger and rage. He went right to vengeance. And I mentally messed with that fellow's mind for a long time, just subtly. Because I didn't feel he deserved to be part of these rooms. And the only one in the end that ended up staying clean was me. And one of the guys that I sponsored seen what was going on and dropped me as a sponsor. I was devastated because I had been with him for quite a few years. And you know, whenever I woke up and did the work I needed to do with my sponsor over that, what I learned is that there was one difference between me and God. He never once thought he was me. Meant to be funny, but it's also serious too, because so often, you know, I'll try to take that handle and it's my vision, it's not God's vision, what I think God wants. And you know, that was so wrong. In the end, what I learned was that when we get in here and we stay here, we're entrusted with a valuable asset. And what that is attraction. And from that moment on, it's been, I don't know the word I need to use here, I'm speechless on the word I need. It's been imperative that I do not allow myself to slip in that manner again. I am extremely hard on myself at adhering to the utmost standards of what I believe my morals or my higher powers' morals would have me be, because I want to be a servant to my higher power. Because the gift that I've received from being here, there's no way that I could possibly pay my higher power back for the life that I have. The best I can do on a daily basis is live a spiritually grounded life that this program allows me to do as best I can. And hopefully through my actions, others learn how to do that too. Not necessarily through, you know, words. One of the things that my father taught me when I was a little kid was, believe nothing you hear and only half of what you see. And we know that to be true, don't we? We sometimes see people talking from sitting in the meetings, don't we? Then they're outside doing the exact opposite. You know? And we're all guilty of that at some point. But at what point in our journey do we step over that line and that's not acceptable anymore? You know, I didn't think recovery would be fun when I got here. I can't begin. Rich was talking about going to land, and we had a blast down there. I had a small team that went with me. We went down to Virginia Beach on the way. He was goofing around. He was a young guy, young man at the time. He was kind of like a son to me. And he was building, you know, he was in the sand. He was doing little women in the sand with their boobies and, you know, it was cute, and I was just laying there chilling, you know, whatever. Then we went down to Georgia, and a buddy of mine, you know, had a fishing guide. A brother-in-law was a fishing guide down there, and we went out on this boat with this guy and had a barrel of laughs, and it was something else to watch this kid reeling in, you know, like 16, 20-ton striped bass, like one after the other. I mean, it was like they were just crazily on that day. And then go over to the convention and hang out with, you know, other people from our area and have a good time. We just had a blast. And I didn't know that you could do that stuff before I got clean. Because those drugs told me where to go, who to go with, how to get there. Or if I didn't have them, I needed to do what I needed to do in order to go get them. I didn't allow time for that other stuff. And if I did have money, I wasn't spending it on a trip to Atlanta. I was going to get more dope. And if I had a pile of dope and didn't need more dope, I was going to get more dope. I wasn't buying another vehicle because I had the extra cash. I'm buying more dope. More. You know, and I've been to a bunch of world conventions. That's the beauty of weed, too. It's like the stuff that we can't afford to do. When we pull together, you know, we're able to do stuff. Rich left that one thing every November. Years ago, I started renting a house up at Seven Springs. And I think originally we did that for the area committee, didn't we? And it's kind of evolved over the years, and it's been through its different roles, but it's fun. That's probably one of the biggest things I look forward to every year. You know, and because it's just relaxed and chill, and I get to see people from Pittsburgh. I don't get to see, you know, that I grew up in recovery with. And you know, I never thought I'd have a life when I got here. When I got arrested that day, I couldn't have believed that I'd do the things that I do today. I just got back from a trip. My buddy that I work for calls me up. This is not like him. Kind of caught me off guard. He asked me if I was taking vacation. I said, no, just, you know, a couple of the retreats and that. And he's like, why don't you come off the Canada with us? He says, you got the ultimate speedboat. And kids that have fun, you know, wakeboarding and all that. And I said, well, I need to check the schedule. And the short of it is I was able to go. But then after I told him, yeah, I started thinking, you know, they changed the rules on going across the border, and I got a felony arrested. I was all in my head about it. I just told him, made a commitment. I don't even know if I'm going to be able to go across the border. If I get stopped at the border, how am I going to affect the rest of the people that are going? And, you know, I forgot that, like, five of the other families, for people in recovery, they have time more than I did. But
Yeah, I ended up getting to, you know, drive up the border with a speedboat behind my vehicle and go 8 hours into, or 6 hours into Canada into a land called 30,000 Islands. And it's just like be free and go back and coast and meditate. And, you know, if you had told me I'd be doing that before I got here, I wouldn't have believed you. The only thing that stood in my way was me. Well, I learned how to get me out of the way. Life started to happen. And I believe that my higher wants me to have all these great things. It's me that gets in the way. But the most valuable thing that he wants me to have is a relationship with you and others. Because that's the thing that can't be replaced. Material stuff can be replaced. It's nice to share and have fun with other people. You know, I try to honor that, anything I have. My friends all know I'm real good about sharing what I have. And I believe it was given to me for that purpose. Funny thing happened on this trip. I didn't talk about relationships up here. And I guess that's where I'll probably end up. But I wasn't paying attention while I've been talking. Relationships. Don't get in them for a year, right? No 13 stepping, right? I had a label being a 13 stepper. It took me a lot of years to break that label. I actually have a 13 step clean date. I'm proud of that. Glad you find that amusing. But part of what ended up me being in this area was I was a DNA counselor, and there was a lady that came in, and she was real fancy to me, and I was fancy to her too, but I didn't lead on that I was. I used it against her in treatment. But when she left, her roommate gave me her phone number, and instead of throwing it in the garbage can, I eventually called it. And I ended up in Indiana, Pennsylvania over that. And I ended up with two stepdaughters. And one of the things that I left out, part of the reason why I got arrested when I got arrested, was I was involved with a lady that got pregnant. And she chose to have an abortion. And I couldn't change my mind even if I wanted to. And I didn't really try, which I'm ashamed of, but when she, after the abortion was over and she came out of the room, I asked her why she had it, and she said, what kind of father would you have been? And that's when I went off the deep end, and within a month, I was arrested, however you want to look at it. And that was the beginning of the life I have now. So when I got involved with this lady and she had two kids, and they started calling me dad, that was real precious to me. You know, that said something to my self-esteem and my self-respect, and I valued that. And for a long time, the oldest daughter, even when that relationship came to an end, because she eventually kept relapsing, and I couldn't, just crazy stuff happened. And I finally surrendered and let go. What kept me trapped in there was the kids. I kept telling myself, if she burns the house down and the kids are in it, how would I feel? You know, and I didn't know how to trust God with that. And I finally did leave, and it's because it just got to the point. I mean, I caught her when they were due. They're stark naked. And the crazy part is, the night they caught them that way, none of that old behavior that normally would have came out of me, because I had just come back from Baltimore doing a seventh step. And the blatantly outstanding thing that I had from it was a deeper level of understanding the truth. And as I stood there looking at what I was looking at, the overwhelming thought was, is this what I want to spend the rest of my life with? That was the truth. And why should I, you know, go into a rage and beat the shit out of somebody and walk away? And that's what I did.
I ain't saying that, you know, I had to wrestle my demons in the next couple weeks. And that wasn't the last 13 steps. Every 13 step I was involved with, none of them managed to stay in the program. One's back in the program that I know. She's been trying to get a hold of me for years, and I just don't respond. I don't feel it's appropriate for me to. What I can tell you about 13 step is the last time I did it, I didn't jump right into it. She got in that clubhouse with me, and I took her in because she came off the street. She was beat up bad, and I became friends with her. It was the first time I became friends with anyone before jumping in the sack. And I thought, knowing all my knowledge, because I did everything wrong so far and made the mistakes, I could do it right this time. And we were going over to Altoona. I was speaking, and she said, "I want to thank you." And I said, "For what?" She said, "For staying out of my program." My chest went out, my head got a little big, and like, I knew I could do what I thought I could do. And the following weeks, he started shredding the shit out of my program. You know why? Because she was starting to do step work. It was too hard for her. She couldn't look at herself. It was easier to look at me. The last lesson I needed to learn about why it's wrong to be in a relationship doing 13 step stuff is because it's too easy for them to look at us and become a scapegoat. You know? We need time to get with ourselves. When we're with someone else, it's too easy to fixate on that person to avoid ourselves. It's just like a drug. That was the last person I ever got involved with. Me and my old sponsor used to joke around about it. He did it more than I did. You know, we think it's, you know, that year thing came from some old fart that couldn't get laid, so he figured if he couldn't, no one was. But there is some healthy stuff to that. My twist on it is my journey, I didn't really know who I was or what I had to offer until after I was done with the seventh step. So until I did that, I really didn't have any business in committing myself into a relationship. Not that I, you know, couldn't date or something, but committing myself into a relationship until I really knew what I was bringing to the table. Because one of the things that was blatantly obvious about the 13 steps that I was in was I always looked at them with the vision that they could be. Not that they were. They could be this person. Not that they were this person. And my sponsor used to, in the fourth step, have us write a list about qualities we wanted in a relationship. And he let us go on about, you know, good looking, intelligent, funny, anything else you ever had, bird fights, anything else, name a couple more things, good qualities. And when you run out of things, he'd say, "Let me ask you something. What would someone like that want with you?" And the point he was getting across is that we got to become the kind of person that will attract someone that's healthy. You know, because water seeks its own level, right? You know, I got hurt real bad about 3 years ago. I got re-involved with someone that I almost married about 10 years ago. And it's this, you know, the story I told you about the shingles and perception. I met this lady at a world convention, 50th anniversary. So my head's, you know, well, it's so unique and special because that's where I met her and it's meant to be. And we got to watch how we talk to ourselves and how we set ourselves up. Because, you know, I found out she had this nonprofit organization. I've seen all these wonderful things that she was doing, supposedly wonderful things that she was doing. And I bought into it and I blew her up into something that took me 8 years to find out was a lie. And for the last 3 years, I've been shut down. I've walked on. I ventured out once about a year ago for like a minute. That was it. And what I've come to realize, and I've always known this, but for some reason my mind has just completely blocked it from me, is that when I'm on lockdown like that, I'm not living. I was designed to take risks. I was designed to present myself in situations to become vulnerable, because it's whenever I have the opportunity to feel and engage life. When I'm on lockdown, that's a type of prison. That ain't living. And so onwards to the Canada trip. It was a family trip, and I was invited up there before, and I said no, because I felt like a third leg. I'm single, no kids. And he talked me into going. He told me, when I was questioning about going across the border to Canada, he told me to call Polly. I called Polly, and I said, Paul, you know, the rules have changed since I went up last time. What about going across? He's like, dude, don't worry about it. You're going to be the all-American family. They ain't going to mess with you. I said, I'm a single white man, and you called Denali towing a speedboat with Harley plates, the all-American family. He started laughing. He said, oh, no, you're going to have some lady and her kid with you. He's like, you'll just put a polo shirt on. You'll be fine. He said, you're looking like the family. I said, a lady and her kid, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, you don't know. They're fixing you up. I said, no. He's like, oops. Maybe I wasn't supposed to say anything. So the short of it is I call my friend's wife and I say, hey, what's going on? You know, like, no, we're not doing that. We're not. She is really pretty, though. She's gorgeous. And so I go on the trip, and I couldn't see this lady physically. I don't know what it was. My eyes were blind whenever I looked at her. But what I did see was what she was doing with her kid. She was doing daily devotionals and meditations every morning with her kid. And there's a lot of stuff like that going on with her. And the more I seen of it, slowly my eyes started opening up. And before the week was up, you know, we were like, somehow it's like we were just inseparable the whole week. And I wasn't looking for a relationship. And I'm in one. You know, it's, I was on lockdown. Sometimes it pays to be patient. I ain't saying it's going anywhere. But it's looking pretty good at this point. And she's never been married. There's not a lot of history to be worried about. She's got a bike. I got a bike. I got a nice car. She got a 70 Pontiac Le Mans. She's got a kick-ass house up in the mountains in State College that looks down the valley. At Beaver Stadium, I got a house on the lake. The point is that this lady has stuff that is equal to my levels. It's not that I'm looking for, you know, getting involved with someone that I think can be. Yeah, but we just learn how to do that if you're showing up here in trial and error. I mean, I didn't learn how to do that right away. Bump my head enough times. You know, I have the ability to keep my eyes open. So far, the only thing I can find that's a flaw in this lady is she's a freaking Patriots fan. That's going to be a tough one, walking down the street in a Steelers jersey and her in a Patriots jersey. Yeah. I don't know. One thing I guess I just ask everyone, when you leave this weekend, you go back to your home group, don't be so caught up in your friends there. Not that they're not important. Be caught up in paying attention to the new guy that walked in the door. It's in the shadows. Because life's precious. You know, we get caught up in so much stuff in here that we forget that this is about living or dying. It's truly about living or dying. And sometimes the death ain't a physical death. Sometimes it's spiritually, mentally, or emotionally. And sometimes it's not that newcomer that's walking in the meeting that we're missing. Sometimes it's that we're missing the person that's got time that's there. It just doesn't look right, but we're taking it for granted. We're not one another and saying, hey, you okay? Give them that genuine hug and give them the opportunity to open up because maybe they're just, you know, full of shame or whatever it is that's blocking them up that they're not talking about it. You know, and if you can, I've been guilty of it over the years. Don't talk about others. Not unless you're saying something nice and encouraging and building up positive self-esteem and belief. Because when we do the opposite, that does absolutely nothing to enhance our first tradition. All that does is break down and destroy our first tradition. And that first tradition allows us all to have what we have. Thanks for letting me share.